Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, August 15th, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And you may have noticed that I did not have a new show last week, and I really appreciate everybody's patience and understanding. As you know, I recently had a pretty major life-altering surgery, and although my body is really healing quickly, I'm there are days that I don't even remember that I went through this. The scars are fading. The pain is receding. There is still a lot of emotional turmoil and fallout, and it's been a roller coaster. I'm also planning to move across the country for my PhD internship. I'll be moving actually in just a couple of weeks. So I'm packing up my whole house here in Los Angeles to get ready to head out to the Fort Lauderdale area. It's a lot. there's some personal life stuff, you know, life sometimes gets in the way. So anyway, I had to take some mental health days last week. You probably know that I struggle with clinical depression. I take medication. I see a therapist. I needed a little bit more. I might be struggling with a little bit of PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and really just trying to figure out what's going on. You know, The first menstrual cycle that you have after a hysterectomy is confusing, and it's a lot. So thank you so much for being there, for being understanding, for being patient with me, and for all of your incredible support online, both in social media, obviously in person for those of you that I know, and through the ways that you support the show. I guess that's a good seg to thank my patrons this week. So remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. That's because I really heavily rely on listener support from individuals just like you, and I use the Patreon platform for that. So you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. And you can pledge any amount per episode. Anything helps. If you pledge as little as $2 an episode, you have access to ad-free versions of the show. And of course, any amount that you help or that you pledge offsets the cost for others, because a lot of people can't afford to pay for their podcast, which is perfectly understandable. And I don't ever want to charge those people to listen. So I really, really appreciate those who can and those who do. This week, I want to give a shout out to my top patrons. These are the patrons in the coolest person in the universe and the coolest person in the galaxy tier. And they include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, David Compton, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, Joe Wilkinson, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman. Thank you all so, so, so much. You're amazing. So on that note, let's go ahead and dive into the show. I had the awesome opportunity to chat for a little bit of time, not long enough. We're going to have to collectively work to get her back on the show with Dr. Jingmei O'Connor. She's the Associate Curator of Fossil Reptiles at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. And she is colloquially known as the punk rock paleontologist. She's written over 130 scientific papers, 5 book chapters, and even a children's book on the early evolution of birds and other flying dinosaurs. She is such a badass, and we had a really fun chat. So let's just dive into it. Without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Jingmei O'Connor. Well, Jingmei, thank you so much for being here with me today.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to Talk Nerdy with you.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to chatting with the punk rock paleontologist, which I think is such a great moniker, being somebody who loves punk rock myself. So I'm like, ooh, do we talk about music? Do we talk about dinosaurs? Do we talk about SciComm? Do we talk about academia? So many things. But before I guess we talk about anything, let us know what it is you're up to right now, because we are connecting from across the country, right? You are based in Chicago now.
Yes, I am. Yeah. So I'm at the Chicago Field Museum. And what I'm doing right now, well, as a curator, it's always many, many different things. I guess very recently, I just got back from the field. So that was very exciting, doing some, collecting in the Hell Creek Formation in Montana. And but now I'm back in the office. And right now, I mean, boring things, like we're looking for new colleagues, which is, I mean, it's exciting in one aspect, but it's also like, you know, a lot of bureaucracy. And of course, just, you know, my fingers in many different projects, student projects, my own projects, you know, postdoc projects. And yeah, so many, many things.
And so as So I see here that your title is that you're associate curator of fossil reptiles at the Field Museum. And so help us understand, for those of us who maybe aren't familiar with the relationship between academia and museum science, you have a lab, you have students, you have postdocs. Are they enrolled at local universities? Are they able to get their training through the museum? Like, how does that work? Is there a partnership there?
Yeah, so the Field Museum is not a degree-granting institution. Like, for example, the AMNH, the American Museum of Natural History in New York, is a degree-granting institution as of like 12 years ago or something. So the students who I work with will have to apply to University of Chicago and then can work with me through that university. But postdocs can work directly in the Field Museum.
Cool, cool, cool. And so are you also on staff at University of Chicago, or is it just sort of like a partnership that they very often work with the Field Museum?
Yeah, I mean, how do you define staff? Like, I guess they probably would not. They would not consider me staff. I don't think. Like, I don't have a University of Chicago email, but I'm a member of what they call the Committee on Evolutionary Biology, and it's not necessarily a department. It's kind of like a committee of all these different people in lots of different departments and lots of other institutions that all work on evolutionary biology. And so students who I work with go through this committee.
Okay, cool. Very cool. Like, what a great opportunity for so many. I mean, the Field Museum is obviously iconic. There are so many great dinosaurs there to study, probably even more than we know because of the collections. I'm curious when, and I'm excited to get into your research soon, but I whenever I have a paleontologist on the show, I always ask them this question because it was kind of illuminating for me when I first discovered this. So back in the day, I study psychology now. I was a neuroscientist and I'm working on my PhD now in clinical psych. But back in the day when I was a kid, I was like obsessed with paleontology and I wanted to be. I mean, I remember my kindergarten project where we made little paper dolls and dressed them up. And it was like what we want to be when we grow up. And my little paper doll was a paleontologist and she had like a rock hammer and rope. And it was like, you know, it was my dream when I was a little girl. And then I discovered, which now I realize wasn't always the case, that many, 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 many paleontologists, actually this is true, but not all, many, many, but not all paleontologists came up through the geology tradition, which was not overly captivating for me. I have since then learned that there's kind of a smaller group of people who came up to paleontology through like a comparative anatomy tradition. Which of those two camps would you consider yourself in? Or did you have a different sort of academic path?
I'm a geologist. Yeah, that's okay. My PhD is in. And comparative anatomy, that's like something pretty old school. It almost doesn't really exist anymore outside maybe a course in a school that is really strong in evolutionary biology. But yeah, I mean, I think if you were going to talk to somebody who had a PhD in that and that's how they got into paleo, you'd be talking about somebody who got their PhD in like the 70s.
Yeah. And I think that's really when actually, interestingly, there's one person on my that I had in the podcast who was paleo, who was younger, who went that route. He teaches gross anatomy at the medical school and he has all of these like other kind of anatomy aspects to his career. But I think it was very specific to like to the university that he went to. Like it was a very small group that that kind of came about it that way. And you're right. Everybody I've had, because I've had multiple paleos on the show at this point, and most all of them came through geology. Did you
I'm not saying that we're all geologists, but comparative anatomy is something very specific. I would say that nowadays, young paleontologists are almost all biologists, but that's different than specifically comparative anatomy. Like there is no such thing as comparative anatomy as a department anymore. But yeah, I think the 21st century paleontology is increasingly becoming biology oriented and much less so geology oriented. Of course, it depends on what your research questions are. If you want to look at, you know, the stratigraphy of these different rock fossil-bearing rock deposits and to see how life has changed through this specific section. So you need to like really understand geology in order to be able to like, you know, create, to understand the sedimentology of these rocks and understand the paleo environment, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, then you're going to be a geologist. But nowadays, in terms of like understanding the functional morphology of the skeleton, the biomechanics, or like really getting at the physiology of these animals, you really want to be a biologist. Or even more exciting is chemistry being applied to paleontology. And like the things that chemists are able to understand about extinct animals using methods that have been traditionally restricted to chemistry, but now we're being applied to paleontology. Like, it's mind blowing. So yeah, I would definitely recommend checking out the research of a young woman named Dr. Yasmina Veeman. And like, she just had a Nature paper that came out like, I don't know, 2 months ago, where she can use chemistry and tell you exactly what the metabolic rates of an extinct animal was. So she's able to show for sure that dinosaurs were warm-blooded, but some dinosaurs secondarily became cold-blooded. And like, you know, evolution is very complex. So it's not just like this you are or you aren't kind of like argument that people had been restricted to previously. Like, are dinosaurs warm-blooded? Are they cold-blooded? Right. So yeah, and that, I mean, that's just mind-blowing. You know, we've always tried to answer that question, but using proxies, like, oh, how big is the brain? And what are like the, you know, the skeletal proportions? Like, longer limbs usually indicate something that's fast moving and that needs a higher metabolic rate to sustain that level of activity, blah, blah, blah. But now she can actually just shoot a laser at a fossil and be like, this is what it was.
Man, that's so cool. I mean, and it really goes to show how rapid, I feel like I remember being in college and studying the philosophy of natural science and coming across a handful of books and a handful of traditions that were, I think, sadly and kind of cynically claiming that, you know, the golden era of science is behind us, that we made all these massive discoveries sort of when science was a very new tradition, and now we're just sort of teasing out all the details, which is bullshit. It really is bullshit, because like from the time, so you and I think we might be around the same age. So I graduated from college in 2004. That was my undergrad. So I finished high school in 01, college in 04, did my master's in 07. And like, again, when I was first trying to figure out what I wanted to study and where I wanted to go, like you mentioned, not only were most paleontologists studying geology, there was no science communication as a field. Like, that was just a thing people did on their own. Now I meet people who are starting college now and who are going into SciComm as a degree, which is very cool. And like, just those things did not exist.
I mean, it's just sadly necessitated by the times. Like, we're now in an age of science denialism, which forces us to need people to make a career out of being like, science is real, you know, like, right, please, yeah, understand science. Like, and yeah,
you're, I mean, right. That's actually kind of sad that's
yeah, it is
case.
Really, I mean, sad. It is. Yeah. It's, yeah, like, people aren't interested in science. So we need people to like try to like force it down people's throats, essentially, like make it exciting and kind of make it palatable and make it like, and reduce it to a level that people can actually ingest it, which also is like in light of the fact that the American education system is spiraling down the drain. So you have to make it so much more simple for people who are, you know, graduating from our current education system to be able to understand, because the American solution to bad test grades is to make the test easier. So like, you know, it's really a product of a very, you know, of just the fall of the United States, really.
Yeah,
sorry to get political, but like,
no, I'm glad, because, and my show we go there all the time. I mean, it's honestly like at the forefront of my mind, and it's not just, there's, I mean, obviously against the background of what we're dealing with right now, there are a lot of different ways we can go and get political. But you're right. There's, you know, there's this part of me that maybe is even a little bit Pollyanna issues, like, yay for the next generation and all of these incredible SciCommers who kind of are coming up through a tradition where they actually can talk about the science of SciComm and they can talk about outcome measures and they can, you know, really put themselves in a position where they're making change instead of, you know, in sort of my group of science communicators, a lot of us were navigating the waters and figuring out what science communication looked like in the internet era. It's like early blogging and podcasting and all that good stuff. And it was great. And, you know, gung-ho and yay for SciComm. But yeah, the broader picture is, why do we need this? We need it because of denialism. We need it because we have leaders in our country, like literal political, like, so, I mean, we had a president in our country who denied science. This is not okay. And it's become sort of the norm to be, and I'm very careful with my wording here because I do not want to use the word skeptic because that's not what I consider skeptic to mean, who have become, let's say, denialists about basic scientific concepts. And it's heartbreaking to see it because it flies in the face of individual public health. It flies in the face of equity and social justice and all of the things that hopefully we're all striving for as scientists. It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's just especially frustrating for me because I spent, prior to the pandemic, I spent 10 years living in China and like all these issues, don't really exist in China. You know, there is no science denialism, you know, and there's, and science is appreciated and it's funded and supported. And I mean, I'm not saying it's a particularly like, you know, paleontology is like a big career path in China. It's actually not. It's really in America where you have all these people who have wanted to be paleontologists their entire lives. It's really not the case in China, where I guess people choose more practical pursuits. But it's just really shocking to then come to the United States and see how things have changed vastly for the worse in 10 years. You know, if you're here, like in the pot as the water is slowly boiling, it's almost not as noticeable. But for me, it's a really stark contrast of things have gotten a lot worse.
Right. So tell me about that, because like you just said, you know, you were born here, you lived in China, you are Chinese, Irish, American, but this is home to you, right? Like you choose to dedicate your time, your efforts at the Field Museum, and this is a place where you want to make a difference?
Well, sorry. Choice is like, I'm not sure that's the right word, because
okay.
Jobs in paleontology are extremely limited. So do you really have a choice of where you're going to work? Like, I mean, I would love to still live in Los Angeles and be close to my family, but there's not a lot of jobs there. So you don't really have the choice of where a job happens to open up that you happen to even get at the time that you're at that point stage in your life and ready to take that level of a position, right? So I actually would have been happy to stay in China forever and ever and ever and ever. But
really?
My husband wanted to leave. And also there were reasons like related to not being able to get a green card and not being able to afford to start a family without said green card, blah, 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 blah. So I had to leave essentially. And then I got the job in the Field Museum. So I was like, well, I'm going to the Midwest, you know? And also, I mean, I never really wanted to return to America either, to be honest. I was really happy being an expat. I've recognized since a very young age, these like really devastating issues in the United States. And it was, you know, very like taking the responsible action of just fleeing from them. but you know, at the same time, I know that the job at the Field Museum is an incredible one. And I am very grateful for it, despite like, you know, having to deal with Chicago winters and live in the Midwest and all these things. Like, it's really exciting to work in a museum, to like enter this museum where it's this massive, beautiful old building and like full of researchers, you know, working on all different subjects. Because where I was in China was all paleontologists, which was also really neat. It's the like only place in the world where you'll have like 80 full-time paleontologists under one
wow.
roof. You know, the Field
oh,
Museum
wow.
has like four of us, right?
Right,
plus
right.
students. And yeah, like that's pretty normal for most institutions. Maybe usually they like a university will only have like one, you know, so the IPPP in Beijing was a really, really unique place. But I'm really grateful that I had my time there, that I got to work on the incredible fossils that are coming out of China, which are just really, at least for what I work on, the most important fossils in the world. And also to be able to experience that environment of having like like functionally limitless funding to support your research, you know, whereas here it's like, oh, I've gotten, you know, just nothing but rejections from the National Science Foundation. And it's super frustrating. You know, they like look for any little reason to reject you because they have way too many applicants and very little funding. So it's just totally different situation. And also at the IVPP in China, like all I did was research, like 100% of the time I did research. And now here at the Field Museum, I have to go to meetings, which in China, right, like sure would have existed, but they were in Chinese. And so like my Chinese was pretty bad. So like I didn't have to do any administrative things. I didn't have to deal with any of the bureaucracy. Like, like outreach and SciComm, not really important, you know, because it's not really a problem there. So we would write a little press release when a paper comes out, but there wasn't, this constant need to like read storybooks to, you know, summer camp kids at the Field Museum, or, you know, all these myriad of other duties that I have. But at the same time, like I always joked that my job in China was like not a real job because it was just like too good to be true, you know, amazing fossils, tons of funding, freedom to do whatever you want and be whoever you want. And so, you know, and I always said, I was like, it's not a real job. And everybody would be like, it's a real job. And I'd be like, no, you don't understand. It's not a real job. It's like a fairy tale job. And so now I'm at the Field Museum and it's a real job. And
it's a real job. Yeah, it's a real job.
Yeah, like, and I have to dress age appropriately and I have to watch what I say because I have a Wikipedia page now and somebody can go on Twitter and me too me for like saying something that they decided was offensive because they're looking for every little reason to be offended because that's American society now. So it's, you know, it's just very different.
You don't have to cover your tattoos though, right?
I don't. Yeah, I don't have to, which is, yeah. I mean, I got tattoos on my neck and my hand when I was in China as a kind of a symbol of like, I'm never going back. Mm-hmm. And then I got the job anyways, despite these, you know, having tattoos on my hand and neck, which I did not cover up for my interview. And so then I got more neck and hand tattoos.
Nice. But, I love that. Yeah, and so, you know,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, like, the Field Museum loves to remind me, like, you're not our first tattooed, pierced scientist. In fact, I think they had one who was even director of research for a while. She's since moved on. She was an entomologist who now works at Cornell. I never got to meet her. But it is really nice to see that, like, these certain things, you know, like about what a scientist needs to look like, have changed. But at the same time, like you can't wear short shorts and like things like that.
Yeah, for sure. But at the same time, dress code. You know, it's funny because speaking of tattoos, I have a big Archaeopteryx lithographica on my forearm. And I remember getting it because A, I loved dinosaurs and B, I loved this kind of new, interesting fossil. I mean, it wasn't that new, but like this interesting fossil of a feathered dinosaur, which did feel kind of new when I was young, you know, many years ago when I got
it. It was
when
found in 1861.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But it also, like, I often would joke that it was sort of like my fuck you to creationists, like that it was a very obvious and clear view of evolution right there on my forearm. And I talked to different paleontologists, and, you know, very often when we read about Archaeopteryx, you read about Archaeopteryx as a bird. I still like to think of Archaeopteryx as a dinosaur. I don't know if the distinction is even all that meaningful, but I know that you study flight, right? You study sort of the evolution of flight. I mean, you study a lot of cool things, but I've seen that you've even published papers on Archaeopteryx and related species. Tell me, bird or dinosaur?
Both.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I always say like all birds are dinosaurs, but not all dinosaurs are birds. So birds are one group of dinosaurs. And and the only group of dinosaurs that survives the end Cretaceous mass extinction. So it's like the group that lived, right? And it's also, I mean, not only did this one group of dinosaurs survive this mass extinction that wipes out all other groups of dinosaurs, but then this group goes on to become the most diverse group of land vertebrates on our planet. So Archaeopteryx is the beginning. It is the first puzzle piece in understanding a great evolutionary success story. So, I mean, I would argue that Archaeopteryx is the most important fossil of all time, not just because it tells us, heck yes. but not only because it, you know, not only because it allowed us to understand that birds are dinosaurs, but also because, and not, you know, only because it's the beginning of this evolutionary story of birds, which is incredibly important, but also because when Darwin published, you know, On the Origin of Species in 1859, he says, like, okay, so this thing called evolution is happening, and therefore, in the fossil record, we should see like transitional taxa that record the evolutionary transition from one group to another. And in the first edition of his book, he says the biggest weakness in my theory is that there are no such transitional fossils that have yet been found.
Wow.
Yeah, but he also, you know, because like he was a very smart guy, he was also like, but we also don't have that many fossils. Like, you know, we haven't been collecting for that long. I mean, the term dinosaur wasn't even coined until 1862. So like 3 years after he writes this book. So so we knew very little at that time. But then just 2 years later, Archaeopteryx is found, like first the feather and then in rapid succession, the London specimen. And I think there was like some naturalist, I don't remember his name, but he was like, you know, to paraphrase, if Darwin had like needed to like concoct some kind of creature that would like show, you know, support his theory, like he could not have done better than, you know, in what we see in the Archaeopteryx. So Archaeopteryx is considered the fossil that demonstrates the transition between reptiles and birds. But of course, if you evolved from a group, it means you are part of that group, just like humans are technically fish because we evolved from lobe fin fishes, Sarcopterygians, right? So, so by that logic, birds are also reptiles. But because scientists are really annoying, in my opinion, instead of being like, okay, birds are reptiles, we're like, no. Because reptiles was defined as a group that does not include birds, right? You have class mammalia, class aves, class reptilia. So if we're going to add birds to reptiles, we have to come up with a new name for it. So actually, the group that includes reptiles and birds is called Sauropsida. So I was actually thinking this when you were being like, your title is the curator of fossil reptiles. I'm like, reptiles is like a, you know, it's like it's like an archaic term that is not scientifically correct anymore. So maybe I should talk to people about changing this, but I think like, you know, curator of fossil sauropsids doesn't really roll off the tongue.
Right. How funny. And so is that, so sauropsids are the, so I often would think of the distinction as sort of like the avian dinosaurs and the non-avian dinosaurs. So you're talking about the avian dinosaurs?
Yeah. So, so that is the distinction that we make when we try to talk about like, you know, talking about birds and dinosaurs, because it makes it sound like they're two different groups. So then you can say non-avian dinosaurs and avian dinosaurs, but sauropsida is like all of reptiles, including dinosaurs, but also including now birds nested within dinosaurs. So
I
it includes
see.
your Lepidosauria, your Archosauria, which is, you know, dinosaurs are archosaur reptiles.
So it's sort of that entire clade that
the entire. So it's basically what we used to consider reptilia, but adding birds into it.
I love that. And so, you know, we sort of hinted to this. Your research area of interest really is in this relationship, right, between modern birds and their dinosaur predecessors. Like, how do you go about studying this big, I don't want to call it a question. Well, it is still kind of, you know, how do you go about studying this big concept?
So, you know, there's paleontologists who use a specific method, and they use this method to answer questions regarding lots of different groups, right? And then there's paleontologists who work on a group, right? So I'm part of the latter. Like, I specialize in birds, and specifically Mesozoic birds. I always kind of like joke, but not joking, say that I lose interest in avian evolution like 66 million years ago. I'm like, all right, modern birds, I don't care anymore. They're boring. But now that I've switched to the Field Museum, we actually have a really great collection of birds that are 52 million years old. So I'm like, you know, having to like eat those words.
Right. You got to update that cutoff.
Yeah. I'm like, all right, fine. After 50 million years old, no more interest now. I'm kidding. And also I've always really say that I'm an equal opportunity extinct animal enthusiast. Like, I don't want to be one of these dinosaur paleontologists that's like, I work on dinosaurs and like thinks that they're better than other paleontologists because dinosaurs are quote unquote more charismatic. I think that's really obnoxious and not even true. And it creates resentment among paleontologists. So like, I really tried to avoid that. And also I got into paleo really late. So I, you know, genuinely had an interest in lots of different organisms and just kind of like stumbled into studying birds and through birds, dinosaurs. So
it's funny. Yeah. I was going to say, tell that to Elisa Panseroli, Panseroli, who I had on my show recently, who studies mammal origins, because she had a very different view of that. She's like, mammals, everybody gets it wrong. And I love that when you talk to people who have like a very core specific interest in what they study, because they are very often the ambassadors for those topics and those ideas. But you're right. Lots of kids only know dinosaurs.
People talk about like charismatic animals, but I think that like every animal is charismatic if you ask the right questions and tell the story in the right way. So like, even if you look at like clams, okay, I'm not a clam expert, so I can't think of any really good examples right off the top of my head, but I'm sure like every organism, once you start looking into it, you're like, oh, that's weird. You know, there's always a good story to tell. So I decided to, you know, like of my grad school choices, because I like, I'm the exception to the rule who got into paleo in college. So like very late to the party. And so I ended up working, you know, accepting a PhD with this man, my advisor, Dr. Luis Chiappe at the LA Natural History Museum.
I know Luis. No way. Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, obviously, LA is very small. Yeah, I did a piece with him. I did a story for some outlet a while back, long time ago now, with that really big, beautiful, what is it, a plesiosaur specimen with like that showed live birth?
Yeah, that's very cool. I mean, all marine reptiles give live birth, so it's not really surprising, but it was the first one to really demonstrate it, so that
yeah,
was
to like capture it
cool.
In situ and like show it in a massive scale. Anyway, so sorry, that was like a little bit of a random.
Yeah, it's super common for ichthyosaurs, but yeah, I had never been shown for a plesiosaur, and plesiosaurs are technically my favorite extinct group of animals. They're so cool.
Really?
Yeah, so I
love
yeah
that.
Yeah, I could have worked on marine reptiles, but the lab that I got accepted to, I was like, oh my God, they're all too smart. Like, and I kind of like freaked out. So I like chose to work with Luis instead. No offense, Luis, but like, not that you're also not smart, but like it was a different, you know, like lots of maths with the marine reptile lab. And I was like, ooh, kind of like, yeah, I was intimidated. So I decided to work, go to USC, work with Luis, and Luis told me, he was like, if you work with me, you're going to work on this one group of Cretaceous birds. I was like, okay. And I had like no interest in birds before then. You know, I was just, yeah, like zero interest. And now I'm like, wow, birds are so weird and fascinating. But yeah, at the time it was just, okay, so I'm going to work on birds. And I was also really excited about all these really crazy fossil discoveries that were coming out of China. Because, you know, I'm half Chinese and was always really excited or curious about my Chinese heritage. You know, my mom kind of raised me to be like, Chinese people are the best. And so I was like, oh, okay, you know. So I wanted to like combine paleo with like being able to somehow work in China. So it worked out. I can work on these birds that the vast majority of specimens, anyways, come from this one area in China. So so you're asking me, how do I answer questions about bird evolution, about how birds evolved from dinosaurs, about the early diversification of birds, about how you go from something like Archaeopteryx, which isn't birdy at all, to a modern bird, which is the most modified amniote, that is land vertebrate, alive on the planet, like so modified that you don't even recognize they're reptiles, right? Because they're just so weird. So the way like I go where the specimens take me. So I went to China where the specimens are, and then you're just, you know, like you have literally thousands of specimens available at your fingertips, and you just like, what does this specimen tell us? You know, and then you glean the information from that and you incorporate methods and collaborators as necessary to extract whatever is interesting from that fossil. So like, I've really noticed that, I guess like, you know, every paleontologist has different strengths. Some paleontologists are super good at chemistry and some paleontologists are super good in the field and just like, you know, just stumble upon amazing new fossils. But I guess I'm really good at connecting the dots. You know, like I'm not like this brilliant person who's going to write some code to like come up with, you know, extract some new information or something like that. But I can look at all the different puzzle pieces and put them together in a way that's like, well, this is what this is telling us. And that's like my unique gift, I would say, because like, as I've noticed that like, that's something that I'm slightly better at than my peers, or at least that's
yeah,
what
I've noticed. So you're a great synthesizer.
Yeah. It's not something special. I'm not like, you know, super good at the maths or like, you know, like there's a lot of paleontologists who I look at and I'm like, you're absolutely brilliant. But this is what I can contribute. So in China, you have all these wonderful fossils and they're complete and they're articulated, which means like all the bones are still connected as they would be in life, like the hip bones connected to the leg bone, you know, kind of thing. And when you have that many fossils, like it's, you know, incredible what you can learn about these animals. So I work on these mostly on these early Cretaceous birds from this place, this region that has produced what we call the Jehol biota. So it records a period of time between like basically 130 and 120 million years ago in the early Cretaceous of northeastern China. And these are the second oldest fossil birds in the fossil record. So the only birds older than the oldest Jehol birds, which are 130 million years old, is Archaeopteryx, which is the only Jurassic bird. So we're looking at like the next, you know, like, so you have this first bird, Archaeopteryx, and then you look, you know, 20 million years later, you have this huge amount of diversity. So it's actually really important for us to try to fill in that gap between Archaeopteryx and the oldest Jehol birds. But we have this huge diversity in China, like, and you know, birds with all these different flight styles that are in parallel to each other, evolving to fly better, right? So that means
cool.
That
so like multiple evolutionary kind of paths of flight?
Yeah, exactly. So all these early birds are flying in different ways because like Archaeopteryx has a very primitive flight apparatus, right? But then it radiates into these different lineages. And now these different lineages are in parallel to each other, like side by side, evolving to fly better. So there, but like in order to fly, you are constrained by aerodynamic principles, right? So there's only so many, there's a very narrow range of solutions, you know? So they're evolving basically the same things or very similar things in parallel to each other, which makes it really difficult to try to understand how they're related and what's going on there. And then we also, to like add to the confusion, we very recently, like say 7 years ago, figured out that not only are birds evolving like similar features of similar flight related features in parallel to each other, but also lots of groups of dinosaurs are also in parallel to each other, evolving flight. Flight evolved in dinosaurs at least four different times. And this is why it was really difficult for us to figure out which group of dinosaurs birds is most closely related to, or which group of dinosaurs birds actually belongs to.
Because which of those evolutionary paths ultimately led to birds if it happened multiple times independently?
Yeah. So the distinction you have to make is this like, so we used to look at these groups of dinosaurs and be like, oh, but they have bird-like features. So maybe that means they're closely related to birds. But now you have to think of it as they're not bird-like features. They are aerodynamic features that birds also have because birds are also flying. So we have like, yeah, so at least two different groups of dromaeosaurs, which are your like velociraptors and things like that, Deinonychus. So like members of that group, at least two times independently and also like 50 million years apart, evolved flight. And then we also have a group of weird kind of like flying squirrel-like dinosaurs that lived actually even before Archaeopteryx in the late Jurassic. And then you have birds. So those are the four different lineages, the four different evolutions of flight within the dinosauria.
It's interesting that you mention, and I don't know, like, I feel like I'm one of these people who, there's so much cool information out there. There's only so many ways that we can really dedicate our time to focusing. And so we rely on experts and we rely on books that we read and some sort of active seeking out of knowledge and then just like some passive information that we get. And so I feel like there's a part of me that always knew that a lot of these feathered flying dinosaurs came from China because of their names. like there was this, you know, it's like, you're like, oh, okay, that feels like a Chinese name. I can't pronounce it. Like, I think they're all, but like, what is it about the region or about, is it like that they just happen to preserve better there or that they happen to explode in diversity there? Like, it's interesting when you see these pockets of organisms where it's like, oh yeah, this is where they are. This is where they were.
Yeah. I mean, it's a combination of a bunch of different factors. Like, some people will argue that there were like more feathered dinosaurs in this region for such and such environmental reasons. I don't necessarily agree with that, but you definitely have a very extensive system of deposits in northeastern China that were formed in the latest Jurassic and early Cretaceous that were really good for preserving delicate animals, small-bodied animals like flying dinosaurs, which are all restricted in size, at least early on in their evolution, and other things like that. So basically, they're a series of lakes, and lakes are what we call like a taphonomic window for the preservation of really delicate organisms. So basically, it means that like when you look at whether or not a sedimentary deposit can preserve fossils, it's a matter of how much energy that deposit was formed under. So the more energy you have, the more any organism that gets trapped in that deposit is going to get broken up. So if you have higher, like if you have like, say, a landslide, you're not going to have any fossils because that is just going to pulverize everything. And if you have like a river system, which has pretty high energy, you're going to get things like big dinosaurs. But lakes have basically zero energy because a river enters a lake and then it loses its energy. It stops moving. So it deposits its sediment load because a river is like carrying sediment with it in this energy, right? And so that means that any animal that falls into a lake and sinks to the bottom is going to get buried by the sediment that's being fed into this lake. And also lakes tend to be anoxic at the bottom, meaning there's like no oxygen in the bottommost parts of their waters. So you don't have scavenger organisms like little crabs or whatever that are going to come and like feed on the carcass. But what you do have are anaerobic bacteria that create these biofilms that will actually hold the soft tissues of the organism in place long enough for them to get buried and even fossilized. So that's why you have all these incredible birds and feathered dinosaurs or feathered non-avian dinosaurs that are preserving soft tissues, mostly in the form of feathers, but also things like lungs or remnants of the ovaries and other like things that are typically extremely rare or even have never before been seen in the fossil record. Now, why do you have so many fossils from this, like not only, so you have the perfect depositional setting to like record these very delicate organisms, but why do you have so many of them? And this, I would argue, is not only because these really good depositional settings stayed around for like basically two little bursts, one in the late Jurassic that like lasted for like 5 million years, and then there's a gap, and then another 10 million years in which these lakes were around and these, you know, these deposits formed. So it's a long period of time. Like lakes are geologically ephemeral structures. They don't last very long. So having lake system persist for 10 million years, that's pretty crazy. But the main reason, the real reason, is because in China, almost all these fossils were not collected by paleontologists. So the first feathered dinosaur that was ever found, Sinoceropteryx, which means like Chinese, a lizard wing, you know, and you'll notice that a lot of the Chinese fossil names are like Sinonithosaurus. They're very like China bird, China dinosaur. This first feathered dinosaur, which like made a huge splash, cover nature, blah, 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 was found by a farmer who was just working on his land and like split open this slab and very cheekily sold one half of the slab to one museum and the other half to another. And also one of the first birds that was found from this deposit was also found by a farmer. And it was found about the exact same time as my boss, Zhou Zhonghe, also found a bird. So, this kicked off enormous amount of interest in these deposits. And if you go to this region, you will look around and you'll just see lush green farmland. And you're like, you would not be like, oh, this is a place that we can find fossils, right?
Right. Yeah. We think of like Hell Creek Formation. We think like that is like the visual of where you're going to find fossils.
you want badlands. I mean, the thing is, in order to find fossils, you need the rocks to be exposed. So that's why we normally go to places like badlands and deserts where you have lots of wonderful rock exposure and you don't have any of these annoying plants covering up the rocks.
Right.
But in this area, you know, you had these farmers who are like, well, I'm just digging here anyways. And then we realize that there's incredible fossils underneath their feet. And so these massive quarries were opened, like going down, right? It's to create the exposure to the rock. But, you know, paleontologists, we're very few in number, and we have other things to do besides dig for fossils. So even at best, we may spend 1 or 2 months every summer digging, and then you have to go back to your institution, you have to prepare the fossils, you have to study them, you have to write the papers, you have to do all your teaching, all this other stuff, right? But farmers who are like, well, you know, I can find a feather dinosaur and make more, and like in one, you know, like exchange, then I could make my entire life farming, right? So there's like an incentive, a monetary incentive for farmers, for local farmers to collect fossils. So you have, and there's also a lot more peasants than there are paleontologists, right? So it's really just like, you know, you have the right depositional, like the right rocks, and then you have the right socioeconomic setting to just make it so that there's a huge workforce of non-paleontologists collecting these amazing fossils to make them available for research. Because I think if it wasn't for the fact that farmers were collecting, sure, we'd still have these amazing fossils, but we'd have like 1/100th the amount of specimens available to us than we do now with all these peasants giving us a hand.
Right. And I can imagine, and maybe I'm being naive here, maybe I'm fully off the mark, but I can imagine that there's also something about sort of amateur collection of these specific specimens because they tend to be smaller and like preserved in situ. Like you were saying, a fully articulated specimen is sort of like in a slab of limestone or sandstone or something like that. And so you can kind of see the whole organism in one big go and remove it without damaging it, without breaking it, as opposed to like a massive sauropod where there's all these like techniques you have to use to get the bones out and to be super careful.
Yeah, it's a very good point and one I haven't really thought about, but like, yeah, if you find a sauropod, the amount of time and effort it would take you to excavate it would, you know, make it so that it might not be as much worth your time. Like in that case, maybe you would just want to do like what's like, it's, you know, in some areas, for example, in Morocco, you know, if you find like a whole skeleton, you might just sell the knowledge of where it is to a paleontologist. I mean, others will just break it apart into a million little fragments and sell the fragments individually. I mean, there's lots of different things that are going on all over the world. But yeah, it's a very good point. But also, a sauropod probably would not go for as much money as a feathered dinosaur that has four wings and like, you know, like Microraptor.
Yeah, there is something that's just visually really impactful and stunning and kind of takes your breath away when you see these creatures. I mean, because you know, they're like alien creatures. Like, I think we got exposed, as you were mentioning, even in the 1800s, we were seeing these, but like, we had a certain cultural view of what a dinosaur was for hundreds of years before we really started to, as a society, evolve our perspective and our understanding of it. And you still see it. When you ask a kid what's their favorite dinosaur, they're going to point to these sort of larger, they're going to say T-Rex, or they're going to say Triceratops, or they're going to say Stegosaurus, or they're going to say like Brachiosaurus. And this kind of smaller, I think, very charismatic, unique, transitional, stunning group of flying dinosaurs are just, they're just weird in the best possible way.
Yeah, but it's also like, I mean, they're weird, but they're also, it's new to us, you know, like,
right.
Like sauropods are also freaking weird, right?
That's but we've true. Known You're about so them. Right. We're just used to them. Yeah.
Yeah. We've known about them for a long time, but also like what attracts us to dinosaurs is their enormous size. So people have a common misconception about what dinosaur means. They think it means like, you know, like scary reptile, but actually it means fearfully great reptile. And so it actually refers to their enormous size, not to whether or not they were like dangerous and scary. So, I mean, I think like, yeah, I mean, humans have, I mean, like, you know, not to be cute or anything, but we have this weird obsession with size, with things that are like bigger, right? You know, and so, Yeah, I think, you know, I understand why these really big dinosaurs attract children and even, you know, attract adults, right? But I do think that the smaller dinosaurs tell us really cool stories about the evolution of this group birds, which is a really underrated group of animals. I mean, they are really, really freaking weird and fascinating. But there's something that we just take for granted because we can look out the window and see them. So because they're with us, they're not as enigmatic, right? They're not as exciting. So
True. We love the sort of the weird, the different, the exotic. But at the same time, I think that there are people among us who have led the way to show why birds are so freaking weird and curious and amazing. Like there are whole groups of people who like are bird watchers, who travel the entire world trying to catalog as many sightings as they can, trying to learn as many calls as they can. And the deeper that you get into liking birds, the more, and I'm not one of those people, but I know a lot of those people and I think they're awesome. So the deeper you get into liking birds and the more you know about them, the more you're like, holy shit, what a thing we cannot take for granted. Like, how
I mean, that's super been my experience. I mean, birds are incredibly smart. Like they're the only groups of organisms that are able to do a lot of things that like humans and our closest relatives are able to do. But because everything about evolving flight is that you have to do it within a framework that is as lightweight as possible to reduce the amount of energy you need to fly, their brains are actually smaller and more efficient than ours. But then they can still do things like read and like have and identify a sense of self in the mirror or to follow a gaze or to learn and remember and all these really cool things that are typically thought of as uniquely human.
Absolutely.
Anyways, I'm so sorry, but yeah, I'm about to run. Okay, so if you just want to do the wrap up and then I'll just jump off. Sorry.
I'll do it for sure. So I'm realizing, Jingmei, as I'm looking at the clock, that you have a meeting that you have to go to. And this is the sad part of talking to people who have like, you know, important jobs and important places to be. I'm also realizing that usually I do a lot of wrap up and we're not going to have time for it. And so I don't want to put you on the spot at all. But like, do you think maybe at some point in time, don't have to promise anything, that we can do a part two to this? Because I feel like I have so many questions still to ask you. Like in the future at some point?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay, good.
No, really, you're going to see why I'm saying this, but in a year, circle back and we're going to have a lot of really exciting things.
Ooh, okay, cool. Yeah, that sounds great to me. Okay, so in the meantime, you've got to run. You've got to go to your next meeting. So do us a favor. Let us know how we can read more of your work and see you online and just, you know, let the listeners know if they're hungry for more, what they can do.
Yeah, well, I'm mostly on Instagram, so you can follow me at Paleontologista, and I do update my website, and there's lots of like lectures and things that go online. So yeah, follow me on Instagram, and then look for cool things.
Awesome. There she is, Dr. Jingmei O'Connor. Thank you so, so much. This has been an absolute joy.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.